myself, Georgiana, Representative Georgiana Lincoln, co-chairman, Representative Pat Carney, Representative John Gonzalez, Representative Betty Davis, Representative Mark Hanley, Representative Mary Miller. We do have a quorum, and on the calendar today is, we have two bills, HB 45 and HB 24, which we will hear in that order. We will be on teleconference today, and I believe presently we have Fairbanks online. If anyone wishes to testify on those two bills, I'd encourage you to please sign up in just outside of the room here, and we will take in order as a sign-up. Presently on HB 45, we have seven people signed up here, and two in Fairbanks. Under HB 45, I believe the sponsor, a Representative Fran Ulmer, could not be here today, and she has instead sent her staff. Would you please, for the record, just state your name and who you're representing?
My name is Diane Lindback, Agency Representative Ulmer. She sends her apologies this morning. She's chairing a finance subcommittee and is not able to be here. House Bill 45 is really very simple. It requires health insurance carriers in Alaska to provide coverage for mammography screening in every policy, which includes mastectomies and the related procedures. So the emphasis here is that as we have procedures which attempt to address a disease condition, that we also include preventative measures. The bill includes a definition of low-dose mammography, the frequency standards for screening, which are recommended by the American Cancer Society, provision for standard copayment and deductibles, and placement of mammography screening on the Medicaid funding priority list. This bill does include mammography screening under Medicaid. There are several people here today who will talk to you about the cost of providing this kind of coverage. It is very low. The state retirement benefits has estimated that at maximum it would cost no more than $1.50 per person per month. 27 other states have provided, mandated this coverage. And if you will note in your packets, there is a map which indicates those states and a listing of those. And among those states are the most populous in the country. This is very cost-effective coverage, a very cost-effective provision. As you may know, 1 in 9 women will contract breast cancer this year. The cost of treating that cancer, if it is detected early, is someplace between $12,000 and $18,000. If it is detected late and most likely will end in death, the cost is approximately $60,000. They estimate that nationally, the cost saving for instituting mammography screening would be over $200 million. So this bill is aimed at both cost savings and human life savings. And as you can see from the map, it is a trend in which the nation is moving. This bill was requested by the American Cancer Society. And this morning, I would like to introduce Dr. Mike Franklin, the head of the American Cancer Society, who can speak to you more specifically on this bill.
Yes, we do have Dr. Franklin listed. And I will take him in that order that is signed up. Are there any questions that we would have of Ms. Linda? You will be here throughout this. Thank you very much. I don't know if there's anybody in the audience who has signed up or has not signed up and has a time constraint that needs to speak first. I apologize, I didn't have my mic on the whole time for the teleconference. Is there anybody online that has a time constraint that needs to speak first? Otherwise, I will take it in the order that we have listed. Fairbanks, is there anyone there with a time constraint?
We have some time constraints on 24, but not on 45.
Thank you. We'll proceed on with 45. First one that we have on our sign up is Jan Young, who is with American Cancer Society. If you would please state your name and who you represent for our record.
My name is Jan Young, and I represent the American Cancer Society and hospice today. Sorry, don't we do that again?
No.
I am here to speak for House Bill 45. As you've already heard, one out of every 9 or 10 women in America will get breast cancer. It's the number two cancer killer of American women. It is not considered a preventable disease. Several of the highest risk factors are things that cannot be controlled, such as family history and duration of menstruation. Therefore, our only chance of saving lives is early detection and early treatment. Most women who are treated early remain free from breast cancer for the rest of their lives. Now, despite the availability of mammograms, the usage is very low. It's only estimated to be 15 to 20% in women over 50 who have even had a mammogram, and it's suggested that they have one every year. One of the biggest barriers cited is the cost, and this House bill could directly address that barrier by having insurance and Medicaid cover the cost.
Are there any questions in the committee? Thank you very much for your testimony. Next, we have Jay Frank with the State Farm Insurance. Again, please state your name and occupation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jay Frank. I'm here this morning on behalf of State Farm and Allstate Insurance Companies. And I'm not here this morning to debate the benefits of mammography. Clearly, the benefits of mammography are laudable. What we are here this morning to draw the committee's attention to are basically cost issues. Any type of mandated benefit obviously increases the cost of the insurance policy that has to cover that benefit. And this particular benefit, although we don't anticipate it's a large cost increase, it's a cost increase in much still the same. And what we would be supportive of is a bill that would mandate that it be offered to any Alaska resident. That way, the individual gets to determine whether they want the coverage and whether they want to pay for it. And it's not a situation where individuals who are not going to be taking advantage of the coverage are essentially subsidizing those that will be taking advantage of the coverage. So clearly, mammography is something that ought to be encouraged, and insurance coverage for mammography is something that ought to be supported. But it ought to be structured in a fashion where the people who will be taking advantage of the service are the people that are paying for it, and not those that aren't taking advantage of the service subsidizing it. It's that simple.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. If it would seem logical to me that if more people had mammograms, if you somehow manage to make more people get mammograms, that you would catch more cancer earlier, and that ultimately, in the long run, the insurance cost would go down because a part of the insurance cost is paying for all of those people who have to have breast cancer surgery. Is that not correct?
That is, through the chair, please. Representative Davis, that is certainly an idea that logically makes some sense, but it's difficult to predict losses. For example, you might detect through mammography at an earlier stage more patients, but over time we know medical expenses are going to go up, so even the treatment for that patient might go up because the medical expenses are rising. Granted, you'll get that patient at an earlier time point, but it doesn't necessarily mean that an insurance company is going to lose less money, because losses, it's hard to pinpoint one particular factor and say that that's going to necessarily result in a lower loss factor, because there could be other factors that influence the bottom line, if you will.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Hanley.
Yes. Do most policies cover mastectomies currently?
I guess the answer is through the chair, Representative Hanley. There are some. It just depends on the policy. I know that State Farm, for example, has some that do cover mastectomies and some that don't. And again, that comes down to a decision that the policyholder makes.
If I could,
please proceed.
Could this possibly, I mean, would there be an incentive for then some insurance companies to remove mastectomies from their coverage, because the bill only applies to those insurance policies which actually cover mastectomies and a couple of other things as well. Would it not maybe focus this more on offering a separate policy or in an additive type thing to the policy, so that this wouldn't be, you know, it might have the opposite effect of what the bill is trying to do?
Proceed.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Haley. That's a very insightful question, because one of the factors, the dynamics that are at work here, and I think you'll hear testimony from other witnesses along the same line, is that every time you add a mandated benefit, you're increasing costs, and at a certain point, it just becomes prohibitive for an insurer to write that particular type of risk. And unfortunately, we in the state of Alaska are not a very big marketplace. And when I say this, I don't say this just for health insurance. It goes for basically any type of personal lines. It has to be a competitive place for the industry to do business, or quite frankly, there are a lot of insurers that simply won't come up here. So at some point, it gets to be prohibitive, and you're correct that this might have that kind of effect, or some other mandated benefit later on might have that effect. But cumulatively, there can be a problem.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm picking on you because you're here, and I haven't had an opportunity to talk to an insurance representative lately on some of the questions I have, so if you don't mind. Just to follow this whole thing through to what I think is kind of a logical conclusion, it's always bothered me when insurance policies do not cover preventative kinds of things, such as pap smears, mammograms, you name it, but they're covering on the other end. If you actually get the disease or you end up ultimately having major surgery, they'll cover that. I don't understand the philosophy. I understand your not wanting mandated benefits. I understand that perfectly. But what I don't understand is why we're even having to come to insurance companies and say and mandate those benefits, because what I don't understand is why you wouldn't want the preventative parts of things rather than having to pay the ultimately larger cost down the other end.
Through the chair, Representative Davis, I guess what I'm not saying that those types of things shouldn't be covered, and I don't think insurers are saying that either. What we're saying here this morning is that if you want to elect that kind of coverage, and it's certainly laudable, that it ought to be a decision that each individual policyholder makes, so that the person who is going to be receiving that service is the person that's paying the premium that reflects the cost of that service, and someone who is not using the service is not essentially, for lack of a better word, subsidizing the users of the service. So I'm not telling you that this isn't a good thing. I think it is. I think but what we're saying is it ought to be made a mandated offering rather than a mandated coverage.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we have Mike Franklin. Please state your name for the record.
I'm Dr. Mike Franklin. I'm a family practitioner, a resident of Juneau, Alaska. I've been here some 20-some years. I'm currently president of the Juneau, of the Alaska Division of the American Cancer Society, and it was I and other people in the Cancer Society who originally approached Ms. Ulmer with the idea of sponsoring this bill. I'll give a little bit of background. There seems to be general acceptance that mammography is a good thing. I'm going to give a little background as to why it is without getting into too much detail, and then go on to why we think this bill is important and should be passed. Basically, physicians have recognized for a long time that the ability to cure or get long-term remissions in breast cancer depended largely on the stage at which the patient was diagnosed. And there was a long time of frustration because it had been known that these breast cancers sit in the breast for years before they can be palpated, even by a physician who does this on a regular basis or by a woman who does regular breast exams. Early on in the 60s and 70s, it occurred to physicians that they could perhaps detect these lesions by doing an X-ray procedure. An X-ray ordinarily differentiates between air, water, and bone. For instance, when you read a chest X-ray, the technology is a little different. When you read a breast, you're trying to read different densities of tissue or water. And so it was initially quite difficult. And the mammography doses, the radiation doses, were fairly high, and there was a fairly low degree of enthusiasm among professionals for this study. In the 70s, two large studies were done, one sponsored by the American Cancer Society, one sponsored by the state of New York. And using 70s technology, which has been improved upon considerably, they were able to demonstrate a clear benefit for women 50 and over getting annual mammograms. They studied over 200,000 people in one study and 32,000 people in another study, and actually did a group of people who had mammograms and were offered free mammography, and a group of people who were offered their usual and standard care and were allowed to choose and to go their own route. They clearly showed that the cure rates in the people who were getting mammography approached 90%, and the people that weren't, it's down around 60%. If you look at the numbers of breast cancer in the United States, we're talking about probably about 144,000 cases in the United States this next year. We're talking about 45,000 deaths. We're probably, if you estimate based on population, 175 breast cancers diagnosed in the state of Alaska in 1991. That's a projection based on population. So now we have a procedure which we think, if widely applied, can save a lot of lives. As Jan Jung mentioned, the utilization of mammography is fairly low. And a lot of reasons are cited. Some of it's physician hesitance, some of it's population patient hesitance, some of it is based on the expense. 27 states, actually 34 states, have mandated some sort of mammography coverage. The rationale here is that given our choices, or if we leave these things as purely optional, this has been done, it's been tried. When left to be optional, or if you can opt to have this benefit, people opted not to have it, or not to have it enough to get utilization increased. So what we have here is an ability to more or less pass this expense on to the consumer, but spread it out, put it on males and on females, and put it on people who are before the age of really needing this mammogram, so it's spread out and it's paid. It's going to come to between $1 and $1.50 a month per provider. The cost, if you consider the cost of an average cost of a hospitalization for a mastectomy, is about $6,000 somewhere in that state. If you keep track of, and I won't go into and belabor the statistics, the cost of treating a person with metastatic breast cancer, it's many times that, and the eventual result is death. And you can, people have, you can always put a figure on what a human life is worth. One government entity that might put $100,000, one might put $1 million. From my point of view, it looks like this legislation over the course of time could save, you know, some 20 to 30 lives per year in the state of Alaska, based on those statistics I've given. That's projection. That's speculation, but it's not, it's founded somewhat in fact. So we're in favor of this bill. We recognize that it will increase costs. The cost will be slight, and the cost will be very easily defined. The bill has in it guidelines as to the frequency of the mammogram. One mammogram would be paid for between the age 35 and 40. One mammogram every 2 years between the age 30 and 40, and one mammogram per year from 50 on. That's the most mammograms anybody could possibly get out of this. Figure a cost of about $75 per mammogram. You figure they're going to cover 70 or 80%. The expense per person is not going to be real great. Plus, even if we do this, our utilization is not going to be near 100%. Probably not going to be 50%, but it's going to increase, and we're going to remove that disincentive that says, yeah, this year I'm a little short of money. I don't think I want to pay for my mammogram. If you contrast also, I'd like to make a final point. Insurance, if you look at the state benefit plan of the state of Alaska, the language in there simply excludes tests done for screening purposes. Mammography is only useful as a screening technology. If the lump is palpable, it's generally not very useful. It's got to be applied as a screening technology. Now, if you go in and say, I want a screening mammogram, and the doctor writes screening mammogram on there, the patient now has to pay for it. If you go into the doctor and say, I have a cough, and I'd like a chest x-ray, he can write cough on the insurance form, and the x-ray, which costs almost as much as the mammogram, is going to be paid for. If he says, I have a little pain in my chest, doc, and he's 45 years old, he may get a treadmill test. He'll write chest pain, and you'll get a $300 test. It will be paid without a wink of an eye. If you go in and say, I want to protect myself against breast cancer, a doc and the Cancer Society said, here's the guidelines, can I get one of these every 2 years? Fine, you have to pay for it. And you're paying for an insurance benefit day in and day out. week in and week out, month in and month out, and year after year, it doesn't make sense. The technology will only work if it's used as a screening technology. This is one thing where the cost is fixed, it's known, it's calculable. We're not asking for a coverage for mental illness or alcoholism. One of these things that are open-ended and can be very expensive. It's very well defined, and the benefit is very clear. If there's any questions, I'll be glad to answer.
Thank you, Doctor. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Franklin, I appreciated your information here today. I'm wondering, do you, through your office, collect fees for performing mammograms?
No. It's in this community, it's done at the hospital only, and at Bartlett Hospital.
All right. If I could continue, I'm wondering then if you would, perhaps you would not be able to answer this, but I'll ask anyway if you might know the answer. How has the cost for a mammogram changed in the past 10 years?
Well, in the past 10 years in this community, I can't answer it specifically in this community. Generally speaking, the cost of mammography has either been stable or come down a little bit. The higher the cost is the test is somewhat labor intensive because it takes a technician and a skilled technician who's directed it and has to do this over and over again. Volume tends to make it more efficient. And mammography, where there's been large volume, the cost of a screening mammogram in Juneau costs $100. The average cost in the United States is about $75 in general terms. There are places where they've done large Cancer Society sponsored screening programs, they've got the cost down to $35 or $40. Increased utilization will reduce cost. General inflation will probably still be there.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Hanley.
Yes, you had mentioned three reasons why people currently don't get them. The cost is one of them. Why is there physician hesitance and patient hesitance other than the cost factor?
I think part of this began with the early results of mammography. It started many, many years ago when the technology wasn't as refined. Radiation is a promoter of cancer, and the original mammograms had fairly high doses associated with them. The current dose is a tiny fraction of what it was initially. And in fact, in the middle of one of these studies, the big study that was Cancer Society sponsored, they actually more or less aborted the study and changed the criterion for women between 40 and 50 because they were concerned about the radiation. And that sent them back to drawing board. And from that, in the late 70s, the mammography techniques were revised and improved, and the doses went way down. The lag time to educate the public is considerable. If you hear that it causes breast cancer or that it causes cancer, the incentive is to stay away. Similarly, the American Cancer Society has polled physicians, and physicians themselves sometimes carry erroneous conclusions about mammography, and one of the things that we try to do as a society is educate the public, and there's a branch of the organization called public education. There's another one called professional education. We try to aim and make sure that our professionals have the state of the art and have the reasonable knowledge. But physicians have cited the radiation and they've cited the expense. And even still, some of them cite the lack of proof that it's effective. Though the evidence is there, all physicians, unfortunately, are not fully up to date on what mammography can do. I think we're in pretty good shape now in this state, but there still are gaps in our knowledge, and that's the reason.
Other questions? Thank you, Doctor, very much.
Thank you.
Next, we have Don Cole. You would please come up and, again, for the record, state your name and who you're representing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Ron Koch. I'm Chief of the Market Surveillance Section with the Division of Insurance. I believe you have in your packets a departmental position paper. I really have very little to add to that position paper other than to recite what it already says in perhaps different words.
Hold on one moment. The position paper is from
the Department of Commerce and Economic Development.
I'm sorry that we don't have that position.
I'll make this copy here right, so you can
thank
copy
you.
From it.
Thank you. Proceed.
I'll just go ahead and...
As long as you know that we don't have a reference to what you're
speaking
of.
I'll read it. It's rather short.
Okay, I was going to say, in for time, maybe you might want to just summarize rather than read it, and we can copy that later.
Basically, the department and the Division of Insurance is not in favor of the legislation as it's currently structured. We raise no objection to the concept of mammograms. We concur that it is an effective procedure for the early detection and prevention of breast cancer. So we have no question about that. Our concern, and the division and the department has in the past opposed mandated coverages. Our concern is that every time you mandate a coverage, you are allocating insurance premium dollars to a specific purpose, which means that the remainder of the premium dollar is not available for coverages that a particular insured or employer may wish to have for his employees, for the things that they perceive they need. What we would recommend is that you consider a mandated offer of coverage rather than a mandate of the actual coverage. That basically is it. We're concerned that as these allocations are made, you tend to have dropout from some employers or some insurers who feel that it's just reached a point where they can no longer deal with it. It's the cumulative effect of mandates that gives us cause for concern. That's basically what I have.
Representative Davis.
Thank you. I realize I'm probably starting to sound a little repetitive here, but this is something that's bugged me for a long time, and this bill gives me an opportunity to ask these questions. It seems to me that what we're saying here from the standpoint of insurance coverage is that it's better to let people just do their own thing and end up paying for them if they're getting ready to die, but we're not paying for them to go in and take care of things early. It seems to me that there ought to be a disincentive for people who don't take care of themselves and an incentive for people who do, and for people who want to go in and get screened and get checked and have regular checkups, because those of us who do that are obviously healthier, and those of us who do that are going to cost less money to the insurance company in the long run. I don't quite understand the whole philosophy, and perhaps if you do, you could share with me why we do it the opposite way. We essentially reward people for bad behavior and ill health, and we have a disincentive for people to go in and get checkups and take care of themselves. I don't understand that.
Thank you. I'm not sure that I understand the psychology that's behind that either. Insurers will sell you what you want if you ask for it. The larger the group that you're a part of, the more likely that is to occur. In the smaller groups, insurers generally take a look at what sells, and that's what they offer. And typically, what has sold in the American public has not been preventive medicine, but rather has been something that responds to the problem after the fact. There's been a number of efforts over the years to try to re-aim that. HMOs, for example, were initially, when they were conceived, were initially aimed at preventive medicine. My own thought is we probably need to go a lot further on public education, and as public education and awareness increases, we'll probably reach a point where the demand will be there. The insurers are going to sell what's demanded. Some of these optional types of things are available. For example, in the state employment, we have the option of purchasing SBS, and that includes a number of things that are preventive. I buy it. Not everybody does. It just tends to be what people will do. I don't understand the psychology behind it.
Representative Miller.
Madam Chair, I'll make an attempt at this. I think the way I look at it, we have an economic system at work, and if we talk about reward systems and behavioral matters, in this case, you are rewarded for payment of costs. I think that's how it appears to me, and that's how our system works. If you pay the cost of the test, you're rewarded by good health. If you buy a toothbrush and use it, you're rewarded for the payment for that toothbrush. And I'm sorry to be so elementary on it, but I sense your frustration, and I understand what you're saying, because it doesn't make sense in terms of modifying people's behavior as far as their health practices. but we're looking at an economic factor at work here. And I'm saying, for the payment of the cost, you are rewarded by knowing what state your health is in. Thank you.
Other comments? Representative Carney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question. This coverage is provided presently as an option, is it or not?
I can't tell you who does, but anything that you can imagine in terms of a healthcare benefit or whether it be preventive or whether it be something that's responding to something after the fact can be offered. As to how many do, I don't know.
So you couldn't give me a figure as to the cost when it's offered?
I could not. There may be some here who have yet to testify that may be able to do that, but I can't.
Thank you.
Health insurance rates are not regulated under state law, as for instance, an automobile insurance policy's premiums are. But health insurance, we don't have that kind of an issue.
Representative Davis and then Representative Hamlin.
Well, Madam Chairman, I guess just in response to Representative Miller a little bit, I understand what you're saying, and yes, I'm rewarded by that, but I also end up paying for everybody else's bad behavior, and it seems to me that if we had a little bit of a change in the way we provide incentives or disincentives, that I wouldn't have to pay quite so much for other people's bad behavior.
Representative Hanley.
On the cost of this, obviously this covers not just state employees, but anyone in the state, whether that has a group policy or how on the state. I see the fiscal note is $270,000, largely because the state pays for the cost of the insurance. Is that correct?
There are others who can better speak to that, but as I understand it, there are negotiated amounts that will be paid for the coverages that state employees receive. Beyond that, we have some optional purchases we can make at our own cost, that we have to pay for ourselves. The state is a fairly large group, and so it has its own experience, and its state employee group has its own experience, and it has its own cost that may be quite different than what, say, a group of 10 or a group of 5 or a group of 30 might experience when they go out to purchase. Because of the size of the group, you also have a different leveraging ability, I guess you might say, in terms of what we can purchase and what will be offered. So it's a highly negotiable type of contract. I don't know if this directly answers your question, but.
Representative Hamilton.
Well, I might just ask if there's someone here from the administration to talk about their fiscal note.
There is, I believe, somebody here from administration that is available to take questions. If I might, we have several other people who would like to testify, and perhaps we can go through this and then call on administration. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We do have several other people, and in interest of time, perhaps we should just proceed. Bruce Cummings, I believe it is.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Bruce Cummings. I'm the Director of the Division of Labor Relations in the Department of Administration, and I here also had opposition to this bill for two reasons. The first is that it is a legislatively mandated benefit, and as has already been testified, legislatively mandated benefits escalate health care costs. I should point out to the committee that I've also been for the last 2 years a member of the Health Cost Containment Task Force, the Legislative Health Cost Containment Task Force. That was one of our findings and a recommendation of the task force that those be discouraged. And I believe all members of the legislature now have or have available to them this report, which speaks in part to that subject and many others as well. The issue in mandated benefits is not mammography versus alcoholism or some other mandated benefit. Our opposition is the total issue of mandated benefits versus mandatory offerings and the effect that they have on premiums. You've heard quite a bit of testimony on that, and I won't belabor it except to say that insurance companies are not in the business of losing money. Or if we were self-insured, hopefully we wouldn't be in the business of losing money either. So they're going to project their risk, and they're going to charge some premium, which has a reasonable certainty of ensuring that, that they're not going to pick up the cost of bad risk of utilization. In the case of state employees, the fiscal note you look at is $1.50 a head. That's not a particularly high cost, although among our total population of state employees, that cost on an annual basis is about $200,000 more than we actually paid in benefits. And I provided the chair a copy of a letter I wrote to a previous committee on the cost of actual benefits paid under the state plan in 1990. You know, it's logical to ask why, if we only paid $70,000 in claims for actual treatment, would it cost $270,000 for screening? There's no completely rational answer for that, except that the insurance company is going to presume that if the screening is available to individuals without cost, that there will be higher utilization. There will be more charges that come in on screening than are currently being paid on actual claims expenses. Whether they're right or wrong, only experience tells after a period of time, but that's the kind of simple premise that's used. The second reason for our opposition is more parochial, but really very closely related, and that is that health insurance, at least for state employees, is a legal subject of collective bargaining. And we've been bargaining very aggressively on that subject for several years now. That was initially one of the primary reasons for formation of the Legislative Health Cost Containment Task Force, was to deal with the rising state employee health care costs. The scope of the task force broadened beyond that as we became sensitive to the difficulty of isolating particular groups or particular reasons for the cost and started examining the larger universe. But in the arena of state employees, we have negotiated a defined set of benefits which has a cost affixed to it. We have agreed, at least for the next year, to pay $385 per month per employee for health insurance benefits, and we leave it up to the employees more or less, in the collective bargaining arena at least. It's not true, of course, for legislative employees, although you have the same coverage, to define effectively what that coverage consists of for the available dollar that we're willing to pay. Under this law, we would not have to deal with renewal of our health insurance contract and the inclusion of mammography, as I read it, until next year when the current health insurance contract expires. But at that time, if we were not prepared or already committed to pay some higher cost, we would deal with it essentially as an issue of, okay, this is another $1.50 ahead. What do you want to do about it in terms of A, reducing your wages, B, reducing some other benefit, or C, having employees pay for this cost themselves? Now, that's the kind of approach we attempt to take at the bargaining table. But by having this subject matter required as an element of the policy and law, one of the options we do not have collectively is to say, we don't want mammography screening in our coverage. You've taken that away from us, as you have already taken away in the area of mandated benefits some other things, like what we will allow for the treatment of alcoholism, newborn care, and so forth. Frankly, we don't like having the inability to deal collectively on a subject only part way. It either should be bargainable or it should not. And now we have our hands tied in certain areas for bargaining, but not for others. And mammography is certainly a laudable type of preventive medicine, but so are a lot of other things that are covered as a function of routine physical examinations. And we do make those physical examinations available to state employees on an elective basis under the SBS program. And they can pay for those with prepaid tax dollars. As a previous witness testified, I have it. I love to use it. I hate to go to my doctor every year, and I think maybe that's why, you know, right now people sometimes don't engage in preventative health. I hate to go to my dentist, too. I just know they're going to have bad news for me. So I put it off whenever I can. But I do, in fact, buy the coverage to get a physical examination. I'm over 40, and I really should have one every year, whether I like it or not. Right now, I do that on an elective basis, but potentially we could make that a non-elective feature of our state employee health insurance plan. If enough employees thought that physical examinations and all aspects of them were desirable to the group as a whole, then they could negotiate that into the state-provided plan and look at other things for elective coverage.
That's really all I have to say on this, Madam Chair, unless there are questions.
Thank you very much. You did mention earlier that you had a letter or something to my office. I don't have that in the file, and I've asked that I don't recall receiving that. So if you would just supply us again with a copy of that, I will share that with the rest of the committee. We will move on unless there are other questions. Thank you very much. I did fail to much earlier recognize Representative Bert Sharp, who is here with us as well. He will be testifying on the next bill, but Representative Sharp, you're more than welcome to join us at the table. We next have, I'm going to ask people to print their names here after I have difficulty with this. I believe it's Risa.
Risa
Gerald. Thank you. You must be a physician.
No, I'm not. Amazingly, no, I'm a lobbyist, and we have our handicaps too.
You state your name.
I used to work for a physician, so I got. My name is Risa Gerald, and I represent the National Federation of Independent Businesses. We have 5,400 members statewide, every nook and cranny in the state of Alaska. Our legislative agenda for each year is established by a ballot. Basically, what that is a poll of our members. And repeatedly, our members have voted in the high 90 percentile range against mandated benefits for employees. What the people basically believe is that you should negotiate that with your employees. Some employees would prefer to have a higher wage, and they'll take care of the insurance themselves, this sort of thing. There's also a problem with mandating this type of coverage. We're not state employees, we're private industry. You go out and you get insurance. You have a $250, $500 deductible or a $1,000 deductible. My husband and myself, we're in business for ourselves, and we have chose to have a $1,000 deductible to keep our premium down. The hospital, I believe, charges $100 or thereabouts for a mammogram. Dr. Akiyama, where I go, charges $171. Doesn't make any difference whether I'm paying an extra premium for this coverage with the $1,000 deductible. I'm still going to, out of my pocket, be paying $171. Plus, I'm going to be paying an additional premium. To me, that doesn't make much sense at all. Even if you have a $250 deductible, you're still going to be out of pocket for money. People make choices. Unfortunately, wives, otherwise, people drink, people do crazy things. They have health checkups, they don't have health checkups. Some people are more cautious than other people. And I'm a cautious person. I have a girlfriend that should have gone to the doctor 2 years ago and has not. And I jumped up and down and had fits, and she still won't go to the doctor. It's a choice. And mandating it is not going to encourage me or this crazy girlfriend of mine to go to the doctor. I'm sorry. It's just, you know, it's going to be there. It's going to be an additional cost. But people are going to utilize it. Females are going to utilize it if they choose to. And that's an unfortunate fact of life. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. And I apologize for not being able to pronounce your name.
I apologize for my penmanship.
We have several other people, two others that are on the teleconferencing, and Mr. Gordon Evans. If we could somehow summarize the testimony, we do have another bill before 10 o'clock.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Gordon Evans, and I represent the Health Insurance Association of America, which is a voluntary national trade association of about 300 insurance companies, which our association. I had given more testimony in the previous committee, and I will make a copy of that testimony available so that it can be copied and distributed to members of this committee. And I did want to respond to a couple of previous people who testified. One, we have the same position that has been adopted by others, by Mr. Frank and the Division of Insurance, that we oppose mandated coverage. Mandated offerings are another story. Generally, the Health Insurance Association does not approve approve anything that's mandated, period, one way or the other. But if it's a mandated offering, it's much more palatable than if it's a mandated benefit, if it's a required benefit, for the same reasons that the others have already explained. It has nothing to do with mammography coverage in general, which we think is a laudable coverage. One thing I'd like to comment on, and Dr. Franklin had indicated that the cost was about $75 per mammogram, is what he indicated. In the previous committee, he said it was a little bit higher. And so after that testimony, I had asked my clients if they could find some information for me, and someone else, I think Mr. Carney, Reverend Carney, had asked this question about what the average costs were. And I wanted to get it in Alaska, because that's what we're talking about. We found out that from a survey of our member companies, of about over 30, about 30 companies that we were able to find, and this information is generally proprietary, so we can't take it from one company to another. We found out that a bilateral mammography in Anchorage or Fairbanks, now the average charge in Anchorage and Fairbanks for the physician and the x-ray was $69. The mode, which is the most common charge, was $44. In Juneau and Ketchikan, the average charge was $89, and the mode is $100. The mode, that is the most common charge. And that's the charge that the provider billed the insurance company, anyhow, where they did that. So, in that, along that line, I have spoken with the with Representative Omer, but not in enough detail on this, about the possibility of having a cap on this. If it has, if the bill has to pass, it would be better if there's a cap on the amount that the, that could be billed. And my company would recommend $60. Now, I apologize to Representative Ulmer, because she's not here now, and I've been trying to get in touch with her, and our schedules conflict, unfortunately. But we would recommend a $60 cap on the bill if the bill is passed as a mandated requirement, that there at least be that cap on it. There was also a comment that, Representative Ulmer's aide indicated that there were 27 other states that had mandated coverage. Dr. Franklin said 34. Our records show only 24 that have mandated it, and almost all of them do mandate actual coverage, must provide, in other words. There are some, and Colorado is one, that has put a cap on it. Arizona, it's a mandated offering, and in Virginia, it's a mandated offering. We found that generally that if it becomes a mandated coverage, a mandated benefit, that the prices that the physicians charge are usually suddenly increased fairly dramatically, 40% to 50% sometimes. Especially if they're going to be paid by insurance, then the prices go up. And that follows some of the testimony that others like, I guess, Ms. Jarrell and others have said, that somebody's going to pay for it, long line, and it's either going to be subsidized or it's going to be the person using it sort of pay for it. And I believe, Madam Chair, that unless somebody has some questions I could answer, that would be my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Evans, and we do have your written testimony that has been distributed as well. We do have several other people who wish to speak that are on the teleconference, and we do have another bill I have to remind the committee to hear. We will go to the teleconference to Fairbanks, Viva Becker. If you would please state your name and who you are representing, and then after that, Margaret Gray. Please proceed, Ms. Becker.
Thank you. I'm Viva Becker, Fairbanks Interior Unit, American Cancer Society, Public Education Chairperson. And the subject is House Bill 45. I'm in favor of it, the mammogram and the insurance writ. My resolution is to provide appropriate medical screening care and follow-up assistance of the women of Alaska, underinsured and uninsured victims of breast cancer. Whereas my doctors, or many of the doctors, refuse to treat patients who are covered only by Medicare, whereas Medicare Part A is costly, whereas Medicare does not provide long-term care at home or in nursing home if you have incurable breast cancer, whereas many women cannot afford annual checkups or diagnostic tests like mammograms or other specialized tests because they don't have insurance, Medicaid, or Medicare, or clinics or doctors will not accept them, and this is a problem in the interior. Whereas many insurance policies do not cover extended care, nursing home or in-home follow-up needed by patients recovering from cancer. Whereas family resources can be totally depleted from the long-term treatment necessary to combat cancer. We have seen families lose their home, their car, their self-respect, and the patient dies from not early checkups. Whereas many employers do not provide employee health insurance, which leaves workers without comprehensive financial support for medical treatment. Whereas women need a doctor's permission to get a mammogram, either at the hospital or at the breast cancer detection center, and insurance is a factor in the decision to visit a doctor. Whereas Alaska women need health insurance, which is affordable and provide long-term provisions for cancer patient care. Therefore, it resolves the American Cancer Society, which has prevention and education as one of its main components, encourages the 17th Alaska State Legislature to advance House Bill 45, which will provide insurance coverage to mammograms, making them available to more Alaskan women. And our death rate up here is higher from breast cancer than it is in the lower states because we are not getting the women in for mammograms. Thank you very much.
I thank you for your testimony, Ms. Becker. Is Ms. Margaret Gray there, please?
This is Margaret Gray. It took me a long time to be Miss.
I apologize.
I just kidding. I'm a board member on the Breast Cancer Detection Center, and a former public health nurse. I'm speaking for House Bill 45. Breast Cancer Detection Center was set up just to do mammogram screening, but they're not done unless recommended by an MD. If you have no private doctor, we have two volunteers come into the center and do this. So in the way, this cuts down on expenses on many people. Education is now part of our program. We use much of the American Cancer Society material. And I think our efforts can be put maybe more towards awareness if the House Bill 45 is passed. Hopefully research will make House Bill 45 not a necessary item. Thank you.
I appreciate your testimony, Mrs. Gray. Is there anyone else there in Fairbanks that didn't have an opportunity to sign up that wishes to testify on HB 45?
This is the moderator, and we do have one more person to testify. Thank you.
Would that individual please state their name for the record and proceed, and who they're representing as well?
Okay, my name is Trish Newbert. I am the director of the Breast Cancer Detection Center of Alaska. I am here in support of House Bill 45. Mammography is the only proven tool we have for detecting breast cancer at an early enough stage to improve the odds of successful treatment. It is a fact that one out of every nine women will get breast cancer at some time in their lives. It is also expected that 140,000 women in America will die this year because of breast cancer. Early detection through screening mammography could drastically reduce that number. Making mammograms part of an insurance package would make mammograms more accessible. It is my understanding that the NFIB is opposed to this bill, so getting away from the social, humane issue of saving your mom, wife, sister, daughter, let's look at the economics of this bill. The state analysis is that it will cost $1.50 per employee per year. I realize that for the small businesses, that premium will be substantially higher. But the cost of treating an early-stage cancer is about one-tenth the cost of an advanced stage, not to mention the lost workdays, which probably correlates to the cost of treatment. I believe one has to look at the whole economic picture in order to see the worth, dollar-wise, of the initial cost in higher premiums. It is also my understanding that 31 states already have this law in place. Please send the signal to your constituents that you also care. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. I was going to also let the committee know that the Labor and Commerce Committee also reviewed the bill and passed it out of their committee with no changes.
Madam Chair, this is the moderator in Fairbanks.
Yes.
We do have one more person to testify on this House Bill 45.
In light of time, I know we had some other people here that also wished to testify on the bill, but we do have another bill that is before us, and unless they want to make a very brief statement, I'm going to proceed. Would that individual make a brief statement?
Yes, I'll make it very brief.
Please state your name and who you represent.
My name is Doris Lennig. I'm also a board member of the Breast Cancer Detection Center. I've been on the board for pretty close to 10 years, I think. And I'm sure that they've already explained to you what the Breast Cancer Center does. I thought I might just mention that while we do not charge, we're averaging around 170 to 180 mammograms a month. And then we are also doing them for the Bassett Army Hospital. We do accept donations if people want to make donations. Many people are very, very willing to give us their insurance information, but probably less than a third of those insurance claims are ever honored. Or honored to any extent to be any help. We estimate that the cost of doing a mammogram, having it read, all that sort of thing, is not less than $125. So it seems to me that health-wise, we're going to be much further ahead paying $125 for a mammogram than the thousands and thousands of dollars that it takes to treat a person once they found she has cancer. Was lucky. I discovered my cancer in 1976 by a personal breast exam, but it was early enough that I have lived a healthy life since then. And I just feel very fortunate, and I just think that if more people were encouraged to have early mammograms, there would be more of us living our full life in a very healthy state. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions of the committee? Any further questions, comments?
About the bill in general?
About the bill in general.
I have a lot of questions and comments, but I thought you said there were other people to testify.
I don't believe that we have anyone else, and we have a number of people that's waiting to testify on HB 24.
Oh, not this one. Okay.
Representative
Madam
Chairman,
Gonzalez. Madam, I would suggest that we leave it on the table for now and come back to it. There is a lot of questions, obviously, on this thing, and I also have some concerns over it. I don't think we want to get it out today, if that's what you're after.
What is, then, is that the general consensus of this committee to hold it over? If we hold it over, then we will be holding it over for until week after next.
Madam Chair, I don't think that's a big, really a big problem, because I think that, how many, does it have too many other committees to go through?
One more.
Just finance?
Finance, yeah.
Just the finance.
I don't imagine the finance committee will take it up immediately once they get it anyway, so perhaps another couple weeks wouldn't hurt.
Would you suggest that maybe this go to the committee and maybe have some work done in the committee, and that might save a little bit of time? We do have a number of bills, as I said, that I'm not trying to necessarily get all the bills out, but that we do have a number of bills that we are, I believe, calendaring already. It would be the next time would be the 5th of March, which would be Tuesday. And I would then assign as the chair for HB 45 a committee headed by Representative Betty Davis, and she can select those that she'd like to serve on that committee.
Madam Chair, I have no problem doing that, but I would like for the committee to share with me what their concerns are prior to that committee meeting.
Yes.
And we don't have time to do it today. You can send it to me in writing.
And just for your information,
Representative Hanlon.
This has some major policy calls, as far as I can see, on a lot of different issues. And to me, it's almost something that the whole committee needs to be involved in, because I think there's a lot of issues. And we can go through and debate them, but I suspect
this
that
will have to come back.
It's going to come back and take some time at the full committee as well, just so you're aware. Because I think there are some major issues that
perhaps Representative Davis could set up a time and just notify the rest of the committee members if they're interested in attending. If all of them are, then that gives us an opportunity to do so.
Yeah. I still agree with Representative Hanley that there should be some more discussion with the full group. Even when we do it in subcommittee, I suppose there'll be reason to discuss it further.
I'm sure there will be. Thank you. We will now take up HB 24, and we have the sponsor here, Representative Bert Sharp. We have several people that are signed up to testify. There are four that are signed up to testify, and I believe there are three or four in Fairbanks that have also signed up to testify. I apologize, Representative Sharp, for our time allocation here, but please join us, and perhaps that you could make your statement on HB 24.
Thank you, Chairman Lincoln. I really appreciate and want to thank you and the rest of the committee for scheduling a hearing on this. This is a bill proposes some legislation that I feel is going to take a lot of work from a lot of people, and I really appreciate the opportunity to get it out on the table, and maybe we can achieve some good legislation at the end of the run. I've introduced HB 24, which would make HIV testing mandatory for persons convicted of sexual offenses. After expression of concern from several areas around the state, particularly the concern on the elapsed time between arrest and charge and actual conviction, can be up to a year or more. That loss of time can sometimes be critical as far as the results of the test is concerned. That's been expressed to me. And also from two other areas besides the victims of sexual abuse, peace officers and what I call emergency medical technicians, which their job requires them to respond in case of emergency, where there could be an exchange of body fluid due to accident and so forth. So what I propose to do, Madam Chairman, is to offer a more expansive CS for the committee to look at over the next few days or weeks, and maybe more discussion on it. Basically, sexual offenses, they all recognize as one of the most offensive, not only in the state but the nation. And I think it's sort of appalling when one considers that withholding life-threatening information from a victim who is struggling to overcome the effects of an assault essentially allows the offender to continue more or less a mental attack on the victim long after the physical attack has occurred. Studies indicate that fear of exposure to the AIDS virus is more pronounced when intimate contact is involuntary. To subject a victim to the added stress of not knowing is inequitable and cruel justice. Also, HB 24 requires that the offender be tested. The victim may receive the test results upon request. That has been something that we try to massage into the CS to, as a result of expression of public opinion since the time of the original filing. Many believe this information needs to be made available to help minimize the victim's trauma and aid in recovery. I'd also provide the test results be provided to the Commissioner of Corrections. The Federal Bureau of Prisons report that up to 20% of the prison populations are targets of aggressive sexual acts during their incarceration. A mandatory testing, I believe, will provide the Department of Corrections with the vital information in making decisions concerning housing, counseling, and providing medical treatment to offenders who test positive. The Department of Corrections has indicated that prisoners in the Alaska prison system are presently given a medical examination if their prison stay exceeds 14 days. This exam includes routine blood tests for hepatitis, but not HIV. Some have expressed concerns that it would be more unfair to provide a victim with false results because the methods of testing are inadequate. One of the handouts that was just given shows that 89 study concludes that new test procedures that are available are virtually eliminate false positive results as high as 99.7% accurate, thereby putting these concerns to rest. In addressing the Fourth Amendment question, courts have determined that a government's interest in protecting the health and safety of the general public outweigh the criminal's privacy rights, and therefore administrative search may be conducted without warrant. Courts have held that blood tests are not a significant intrusion into the individual's privacy because they have become, quote, routine in our everyday life, unquote. Your bill packets have information addressing these issues, also recent studies indicate that early treatment, or among other things, reduced the possibility of HIV-infected individuals actually contracting AIDS. Many states have addressed this issue. By 1987, 14 states enacted legislation on the issue of antibody testing. Today, there are at least 29 criminal and civil statutes concerning this topic, and at least 12 states have enacted legislation directly concerning mandatory HIV testing. HIV is not a political debate or opinion. It is a life-threatening illness, which we all recognize. When it threatens the life of innocent victims, it is in the public interest that the government step in and take action. I urge your favorable consideration of this legislation, and I do have a more expansive CS.
That has been handed up.
19. Right. And this incorporates the concerns that have been expressed to our staff and myself over the last two or three weeks. I believe there's some good ideas in there, and I would ask that the committee review that when they have a chance and maybe involve debate on that.
Representative Sharp, could you, I haven't had an opportunity to review the new CS. Could you just highlight for us those areas where there have been significant changes from the CS that was presented on the 22nd.
I'd be glad to. It expands the the proposed legislation to more or less lay out legislative findings and intent of the legislation. It still contains the requirement that blood tests be required for the defendants involved in sexual offenses. It also expands it to require that public officials that are peace officers, firefighters, or emergency medical person that has been involved in the arrest of an individual and upon reasonable proof of possible transfer of body fluids during the arrest can file with the court a petition requiring a blood test at that time. This is similar to legislation in other states and has many court cases that have upheld the right of the state to provide that information to these types of individuals. The bill then goes into a little bit more detail on the testing and test results and the confidentiality, making it available still to the Department of Commissioner of Corrections for the reasons previously stated. And that basically is the expansion areas of the proposed CS, and as I say, reflects some of the concerns expressed, and I believe they're legitimate concerns. And it also avails more immediate testing and results known to the victim and the correction officers who have to provide for the safety and the health of the person being incarcerated prior to trial. Either. Thank you.
Representative Sharp, in light of the time and all that, my intent is to assign this to a subcommittee to work on this and bring it back on March 6th. So if you could, we would appreciate if you would stay there at the table. And we have some people, I believe, in Fairbanks that have some time constraints that wanted to testify. So if you wouldn't mind just staying there for a moment.
That's true. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to... I appreciate that, and the reason, and I apologize for the late entry of this more expansive CS, but I felt I should consult with the other co-sponsors prior to that, and I just did that and finally cornered one of them this morning. So.
Understand. Fairbanks, I don't recall which individual it was there that had a time constraint, but would you please state your name for the record and... who you represent and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Beverly McClendon, I believe, is the first person listed for Fairbanks. She did have to leave. My name is Bonnie McCorkadale. Good morning. As some of you know, I have worked with substance abusers and others with criminal behavior problems for many years. I'm currently working in the AIDS prevention and education arena. I'm here today to testify against further consideration of House Bill 24. I am told that this bill represents an effort to protect and defend the rights of sexual assault victims. The motive is a good one. Unfortunately, HB 24 will not provide any additional protection or assistance for victims of sexual assault. HIV testing without consent presents enormous ethical problems in a variety of areas, but I'm not here to debate those. I am asking all of you to take a closer look at the HIV test itself, how it works, and what it tells us. In the vast majority of cases, an individual will test antibody positive within 6 weeks following exposure to this virus. The individual will then test positive for the virus for the rest of his or her life. The test will not tell us when the individual was exposed to the virus, nor will it tell us who the carrier was. We will only know that at some point in time, the HIV virus entered the individual's bloodstream. Sexual assault victims should be encouraged to consent to HIV testing immediately after an assault, and again 6 weeks later. It would be foolish and unnecessarily stressful for them to wait until after their assailant has been apprehended, tried, and convicted before seeking information about their own health status. Even if the assailant has the virus, there's a reasonable chance that the victim has not contracted it. There is also the possibility that the victim had the virus prior to the assault. Counseling, testing, and follow-up support services will be far more helpful to victims than involuntary testing of offenders sometime down the road. Remember, the test will only reveal the antibody status of the person being tested. It will not reveal the identity of the carrier or the date of the exposure. Anyone who has experienced an exchange of body fluids in a violent or work-related situation should be tested within that six-week period. There are, quite simply, some problems that cannot be solved by forcing people to provide us with information involuntarily. Sexual assault victims and efforts to stop the spread of AIDS will both be better served through education, support services, and the funds needed to provide both. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We do have 10 minutes left, and I believe it probably would be beneficial for this committee and those that will be serving on the subcommittee to hear the testimony of individuals who have signed up. So we will just simply proceed with a Mark Tumio, and if you would be considerate enough that there are four other people who are also signed up to testify. Mark Tumio, would you please state your name and who you represent?
Good morning.
Good morning. Are you still there?
Hello?
Yes. Can you hear us?
Yes. Can you hear me now?
Yes. Please proceed.
Okay. My name is Mark Tumio. I'm the co-founder and past chair of the Interior AIDS Association. I currently serve on the board of directors, and I'm here to testify on behalf of the chair of the board, Ms. Susan McGinnis, and the board of directors of the Interior AIDS Association. We are strongly opposed to House Bill 24, the bill that would require HIV testing of individuals convicted of sexual assault without the individual's consent and mandates notification of the convicted individual's spouse, the victim of the offense, the victim's legal custodian, and the commissioner of corrections of the results of the test. We urge all legislators to oppose this bill and ask the sponsors to withdraw it. We are sure that the sponsors of the bill feel they are working towards a solution to the spread of HIV, and most importantly, towards the protection of victims of sexual assault. We applaud these goals. However, House Bill 24 will achieve neither. In fact, it will hurt victims of sexual assault and impede the efforts of organizations working to educate our communities on the risk of AIDS. Our first and foremost concern must be with the victims of sexual abuse. House Bill 24 will do nothing for these victims. Consider first what HIV testing is and is not. An HIV test will indicate if a person is positive at the time of the test. A test 4 months after an assault, the minimum time for sexual assault conviction after an arrest, will not indicate whether the person was positive at the time the sexual assault occurred. It is quite possible that a person convicted of a sexual assault may have contracted the virus after the crime. And to what advantage is the knowledge that the assailant has tested positive for HIV, regardless of when the disease was contracted? It says absolutely nothing about the status of the victim. A positive test of a convicted sexual assailant is not information that is going to help protect the victim, regardless of whether the victim has or has not contracted the virus. It will only serve to further traumatize the victim of a sexual assault. Anybody who has been sexually assaulted should be encouraged to be tested the day of the assault to ensure that that person who was assaulted was not already positive for HIV before the assault, and then tested again six weeks afterward, the maximum incubation period before antibodies for HIV are produced. No convictions will be completed within 6 weeks. In fact, in cases of stranger rape, an arrest may not even have been made by this point. By the time of a conviction, if it is achieved, the victim should have already been tested confidentially and voluntarily, so the appropriate health protection methods could already be underway. There is no advantage to a victim of sexual assault to force the convicted assailant to be tested, nor in sharing these results of the test with anyone. We must also consider the effect this bill will have on others infected with HIV. House Bill 24 promotes the dangerous illusion that we are dealing with AIDS, but it will only force people away from the realization that they are particularly vulnerable. This bill will further stigmatize HIV-positive individuals anonymous with deviant or illegal behavior. Worse, it will promote the illusion that the average person is not at risk for AIDS. The fact is that a person who commits rape is less likely to be a carrier than anyone who has sex with prostitutes or is promiscuous. HIV infection is growing at its fastest rate among young women between the ages of 18 and 30, not from sexual assault or drug use, but from consensual sexual relations. The second highest rate of infection is among teenagers, an equally high rate for men and women, once again from consensual sexual contact. By furthering the false impression that only victims of sexual assault are at risk, or that only those who are rapists, gay, or drug users are HIV positive, is to place one more barrier in the way of effective AIDS education and to help condemn our teenagers, especially young women, to death. House Bill 24 is also an example of the type of potential state-sanctioned violation of personal rights that all HIV-positive individuals fear. The argument that AIDS should be treated like any other sexually transmitted disease when it comes to testing and reporting is fallacious and based on a misunderstanding of the AIDS epidemic. AIDS is not like other sexually transmitted diseases. Most notably, it is not curable. More important, however, is that individuals with other sexually transmitted diseases are not singled out by society for discrimination. People do not lose their jobs if they are diagnosed with gonorrhea. They are not denied housing, insurance, or medical care if they are found to have syphilis. And no other diagnosis of a sexually transmitted disease will subject a rapist to a potential murder charge or result in isolation from the general prison population. With a diagnosis of HIV positive, these are common occurrences.
Mr. Tumio? Mr. Tumio, I don't know if you have your testimony in writing, but we do have four other people that would like to testify, and we have 5 minutes left. If you can just summarize, please, I would appreciate that. And certainly anyone can submit their written testimony to our committee, and we would appreciate that.
Okay, I'll summarize this. There's two important points. First of all, we will do much more to help victims and criminals alike by better educating the prison population, not separating them out. As much as we dislike the idea, we should make condoms and voluntary, confidential HIV testing available in prisons. We must educate the prison population and give them the necessary tools so that they can stop the spread of HIV among themselves. We know that personal knowledge of one's HIV status can help help an individual take steps to change behavior. Behavior change is the only way to stop the spread of AIDS. We encourage our lawmakers, especially the sponsors of House Bill 24, to withdraw this bill or any bill that requires mandatory testing and support legislation or resolutions instead that will encourage statewide education regarding HIV, promote voluntary confidential HIV testing, and support alternative testing sites, while at the same time protect the civil rights and privacy of individuals who are HIV positive. Thank you, and I stand ready to answer any questions you may have.
Mr. Tumio, I appreciate your testimony, and you can certainly give that, and we would appreciate it if you would give that to the office there, and they will pouch it down to us. We next have the Office of Health and Social Services is here, and I don't know if Tom Bergstrom, if you want to, I realize that the office did not have an opportunity to have written testimony, but if you want to wait until that is in writing, or if you'd like to testify now, it's then we have Cindy Smith, and I might ask while you are coming to the table, is there anyone here who has signed up who perhaps will not be in town on the 6th of March to have this testimony be heard or can get to the committee? Okay. Please proceed.
My name is Cindy Smith. I'm the director of the Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. I promise I'll be very brief. The network at this point does not have a position on this bill. Programs I've talked to have been generally supportive of it. I have not had an opportunity to review the new CS, so I don't know whether or not these concerns have been taken care of yet. But we had several specific amendments we'd like to see made. One would be to allow a victim to have a designee for information so that information as to whether a test is positive or negative to go to her physician or to a rape crisis counselor. We're also concerned that if information about tests is made available to victims, that there be some provision for counseling and follow-up to go with it. We're a little concerned that the state not send a form letter, and that there be some mechanism by which the victim is hooked in. It's another reason to have a victim designee, I think. We think that this is a problem that victims have been increasingly concerned about in the past several years. Our rape rate in Alaska, as you know, is about 1.5 times the national average. And people are raped from age 8 to age 80. And so it is of some import to determine possibly where people have obtained HIV positive results from. That there are some cases you would be able to say, well, this is where that person was infected. So that's all of my testimony to these questions.
Thank you very much. I just want it noted that you said people are raped from age 8 to 80.
Well, 2 and, yeah.
Unfortunately,
to 90 and,
it is lower than 8, and
sure.
that is very unfortunate. I apologize on behalf of the committee for those who have signed up that we have run out of time. We do have another meeting to attend, and I would ask that Representative John Gonzalez chair the subcommittee then on HB 24, and I would encourage anyone that has any information submit that to Representative John Gonzalez, and it's just a pouch V, or you can use the LIO offices to transmit any written information that you would like to submit to the subcommittee. And John, you may select who you want to have on your committee. The meeting is hereby adjourned at 10:01. Thank you all for participating.
Good job.